Hurricane Dorian batters the Bahamas with record winds, up to 220 miles per hour.
Please, pray for us. I'm begging you, pray for us.
I'm Carol Hills. A rescue crew prepares to get to work as soon as the storm passes. And destruction of a different sort in Hong Kong, as protests there grow more violent.
More intense, more arrest, and more spectacular visuals.
Also, an Asian-American musician went with a controversial band name, The Slants.
Several of the initial band members also had similar childhood experiences to mine, so they just thought this is kind of a punk rock in-your-face way of throwing it back at people who use racism against us.
Simon Tam defended his band's name in a fight that went all the way to the Supreme Court. All that's ahead on The World. (laughs) 220 miles per hour. The Bahamas were ripped by the strongest winds ever recorded on the Atlantic Island nation. The government of the Bahamas says the damage from Hurricane Dorian is catastrophic. For a second straight day, low-lying areas on the northern islands of the Bahamas are being battered by winds and flooding. A young mother on Abaco Island was able to upload a video on Facebook Live.
Pray for us. Pray for Abaco, please. I'm begging you. My baby is 24 months old, please. Pray for us.
The young woman and her baby, along with about 25 other people, were taking refuge in the upper story of a building as the water crashed through smaller homes. New buildings on the Bahamas have been constructed to withstand a Category 4 hurricane. Dorian is a Category 5. Eddie Wan is the chairman of the Bahamas Air and Sea Rescue Association and Grand Bahama Island.
Certain sections, certain islands, certain keys have actually been all but just wiped off the map.
And so you're doing this on Grand Bahama Island, where you are. How are you rescuing them, and where are you taking them to?
They have family members, and there's other shelters of which you pick them up and take them to. Virtually just the closest place you can get back to for the next person. And try and get as many as you can on the bus and go from there. It's really started at about 3:20 this morning, I think was our first phone call. And it just escalated after that, call after call. There was Facebook messages and WhatsApps and the like. That's what I was actually on a call when you called me back 5 minutes ago. I was actually on another, working another rescue call right then.
And is there somebody on their way out to rescue those people?
Yes, best as we can. We're unfortunately, you know, we put them on kind of in the number, the order that you call. But at the same time, if we have X amount of people in one general area, then obviously we're going to grab all of them first, or while we're there, not first, just while we're in that area, we'll grab everybody that we can grab.
Eddie, what about your friends and family? Have you heard from them?
We've been so busy helping other people here in Freeport, Grand Bahama, where I'm from. I have a daughter who's in a 12-year-old daughter in Green Turtle Key, who I've not heard from since yesterday. And I have a sister in Hopetown, another sister in Marsh Harbor, and a nephew in Hopetown, who I understand they've lost their homes, and I have not heard from them since early yesterday morning either. I'm just going with the pretense that everything's okay, and we have it in God's hands, and they're going to be fine, and we're going to continue helping people. As small as this area, country is, and especially in Abaco and Freeport, if something was wrong, we would have known. I would like to keep that attitude, to keep a positive attitude. But yes, I do have moments where I break down and think about my daughter and my family.
And your daughter and family are in other parts of Grand Bahama Island?
No, my daughter's actually in Abaco, in on a little outer key called Green Turtle Key. That's why it's tearing me apart so much, because I know the damage that was done over there.
The islands are really stretched across a large area. It must be very difficult to know how everybody's doing with the communication down.
You might get lucky with somebody who might have data on their phone, or might pick up a single bar somewhere somehow, or a sat phone. Other than that, it's really, 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 that's really down right now, the whole, the entire Abaco.
You're a lifelong resident of the Bahamas. You've seen and lived through a lot of hurricanes. What's different about this one?
The power, the fierce brute force that it brought. It was started off compact, and then all of a sudden it just became a brute. It was a very fierce, fierce hurricane. I don't know how to explain it. I'm just the likes of which I've never seen.
Eddie Wan is the chairman of the Bahamas Air and Rescue Sea Association and Grand Bahama Island. Eddie, thanks so much, and I'm wishing you and the rest of the people of Bahamas safety.
God bless you. Thank you so much.
Fight for freedom, stand for Hong Kong. Those are the words of protesters there. Thousands blocked a busy downtown avenue. They shut down the airport. In both places, protests were destructive. Activists ripped up metal grating, smashed glass, and tore up street signs. The conflict in Hong Kong has escalated far beyond the initial protests that began in the spring. Protesters were originally opposing a bill that would have allowed Beijing to extradite people facing charges in Hong Kong back to courts in China. Now the protests have evolved into a wider movement pushing for more democratic freedoms. The World's Patrick Nguyen is in Hong Kong. He tells us that what's happening now feels different than before.
More intense, more arrest, and more spectacular visuals. Flaming barricades, that's new. The police trying to shoot blue dye on protesters so they can track them, hunt them down, and arrest them, that's new. A police officer fired his gun in the air to scare off protesters, that's new. Each weekend seems to get more intense, and you can even say violent. In Hong Kong, there were these massive protests where, you know, millions of people showed up in a territory of only 7 million and came out, and it was your classic super peaceful march-style protest. Well, that didn't work. So now the protesters are turning to more intense and destructive ways of protesting. I talked to this woman who's a mother in her 30s, works in healthcare. And she didn't want me to use her name. She had a mask on. This is what she said when I asked her about damaging property.
I don't care about destroying property at all.
That doesn't bother you?
No. We can rebuild them.
Actually, what are they doing with this stuff?
They need to set roadblocks to stop the policemen coming too quickly. And then these people can leave faster.
So, Patrick, what's at the core of the rage of these protesters? What do they want?
It's really this rage about not wanting to live in an authoritarian country. They don't want to live under the rules of China. And they see the rights of Hong Kong being steadily eroded by their own government. A protester at the airport said it really came down to wanting to express himself freely. And, you know, he said that there's a real strategy behind all this property damage and flaming barricades and shutting down the airport. It really gets everyone's attention. It hurts the economy, which hurts the government.
We see Hong Kong Airport as, you know, the scrotum of the government. So we are holding their scrotums. Yeah, making you painful.
Wow.
That's
fairly vivid.
Quite vivid, yeah. What protesters told me over and over is that they really are afraid that Hong Kong will just become like just another city in China, like Guangzhou, Shanghai, whatever. And that means to them a place where you could go to prison for your opinion, where the internet is censored, and where everybody has to display fealty to the Communist Party, and you have zero hope of choosing who governs you. And that's what they feel like they're fighting for.
If certain demands are met, will the protests end, or is it beyond that?
They would say there are clearly defined goals. They want this extradition bill to be convincingly swept away forever. And they want anyone who's been arrested for protesting to be freed. And they want Carrie Lam, who heads the Executive Legislative Council of Hong Kong, to step down. So they have these core demands. There's so much bad blood now, Carol. It's escalating.
And what about Hong Kong residents themselves? Do you get the sense that the citizens of Hong Kong are still behind the protesters, or is there some splintering there as well?
It is increasingly split, and it's sort of redefining the city. A lot of people have told me on both sides that Hong Kong isn't the same as it was before. Something has changed. And on the protest side, you're really seeing that, where they're starting to use this phrase, Chai Nazi, and they're spray painting it all over town, comparing Beijing, the powers in Beijing, to Nazis. And once you've gone into Nazi territory, it's really hard to come back from that and consider reconciling.
Wow. Vivid stuff coming out of Hong Kong from the world's Patrick Nguyen, who's following the protests there. Thanks a lot, Patrick.
Thanks, Carol.
More political drama unfolding in London. The British Parliament reconvenes tomorrow with just a handful of days left to prevent Prime Minister Boris Johnson from letting the UK crash out of the European Union. Yesterday, Johnson threatened to expel any MPs from his own Conservative Party that try to vote against a so-called hard Brexit. Today, the Prime Minister made a fresh appeal to his MPs to support him in a televised statement outside 10 Downing Street as protesters roared, "Stop the coup."
And so I say to show our friends in Brussels that we are united in our purpose. MPs should vote with the government against Corbyn's pointless delay.
Events seem to be moving at a bewildering speed, but the world's Orla Barry in London is here to make everything clear. Orla, Parliament will be in session tomorrow. What are the Prime Minister's political opponents trying to accomplish with such little time on the clock?
Well, very simply, to prevent a no-deal Brexit. They are coming together from different parties. Some will be Tories, the government's Conservative Party. Some will be from the opposition benches, all with different views on Brexit, but all not wanting a no-deal Brexit.
And how can they do that at this point?
So what the bill, we understand, is going to do is to ask that if Boris Johnson hasn't reached an agreement with the EU by mid-October, then he will have to seek an extension on the deal until the end of January.
And why is a possible extension so unacceptable to Johnson?
Very simply, you might remember, Carl, when he entered 10 Downing Street, he said the goal of his premiership was that the UK would leave the EU on October 31st, deal or no deal. And for him to go back on that now would be seen as he's gone back on his word. Now, it won't be the first time that Boris Johnson will go back on his word. But for this, it does seem like very much a red line for him that he simply will not do that.
Okay, Orla, we've been here before. You know, there's a whole lot at stake. So what's really at stake tomorrow? Are we at a breaking point?
We've been at a breaking point for so long, Carl, at this point. What's most likely to happen tomorrow is that we will see this parliamentary debate get underway. We'll see how the votes go. This evening, it looks like it may not go in Boris Johnson's favour. And if that happens, if the opposition wins that vote and the bill starts being pushed through, etc., the greatest likelihood is that he will have to call a snap election. And then we're into general election mode. It should be said, for a general election, snap election to happen here, it does have to be voted on in the Houses of Parliament. So there is that. But also, we do feel like we've been in general election mode for, since he came into office, because the amount of funding that he's announced for the police, for the NHS, etc., there's a lot of money being thrown around there, which is generally what prime ministers tend to do in the lead up to general election campaigns. So the feeling already is that the party is very much in general election mode. He knew this bill was coming. He knew what the opposition MPs were trying to do. He tried to prevent it last week by suspending Parliament for that period of time through September. They're obviously moving quicker now, trying to get the bill through tomorrow. So it looks like he's stepped in and, a general election is very much on the cards.
You know, those protesters we heard earlier sounded pretty mad. Is the UK falling apart over this?
it's certainly, I mean, it goes between madness and apathy, if I'm being honest with you. The real sense of fatigue has set in. Yes, for the protesters out there, they're very angry. And over the weekend, there was thousands took to the streets of London, thousands took to the streets around the UK over the last week expressing their fury. So it kind of veers between real anger and just extraordinary exhaustion, where there are many people who just say, let October 31st roll in and let's have this no-deal Brexit and be done with it.
The world's Orla Barry in London. Keep us posted.
Will do. Thanks, Carl.
Just ahead, how air conditioning habits are changing and changing the environment.
For them, it was an unimaginable luxury, you know, associated typically with like five-star hotels or the very rich. Now, pretty much every apartment around where my grandmother now lives has an air conditioner.
That's next on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Labor Day is the unofficial end of the summer. And boy, it's been a hot one. Record temperatures seared Europe, Asia, and the Middle East. Paris hit 108 degrees. India went up to 123. Iraq reached 132. All of this had us thinking of one thing for most of the summer: air conditioning. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports on AC's beginnings and its future.
I'm going to start this story in 1850 in the town with the delightful name of Apalachicola, Florida. There was a doctor named John Gorey, and Gorey wanted to cool down the malaria patients in his fever ward. So,
by hook and crook and trial and error, he happened to put together a compressor-driven machine. He had done this by instinct, and it was powered by a steam engine.
That's Salvatore Basil, the author of Cool, How Air Conditioning Changed Everything.
Well, not only did it work, but he discovered that it could make ice as well.
Gorey decided to market this machine not as an air conditioner, but as an ice maker. And he demonstrated it at a Bastille Day party given by the French consul. So it's July 14th, 1850, and the ship carrying the ice from the north down to Florida hadn't arrived yet. And the champagne was going to have to be served warm. So Gorey performs a miracle. He has four servants come into the room carrying silver trays piled high with ice for the champagne, ice that he made on his machine. Now, you'd think this would mean instant business success, but Gorey underestimated the competition.
The industry that at the time was a gigantic industry selling natural ice came down on him hard. And he was suddenly labeled a charlatan in papers literally around the world. And he died penniless with nothing but his patent.
50 years later, an engineer named Willis Carrier came along, and he invented a contraption that lowered the temperature and controlled humidity, which is something that Gorey's machine didn't do. And voila, modern air conditioning was born. But it wasn't a slam dunk at first.
People were very resistant to it. I think it was sort of a Victorian prejudice against being made comfortable. God made hot weather, so you should put up with it. That sort of thing.
Soon enough, though, air conditioning began to spread.
Harry.
You sleep.
Who can sleep in this heat?
When you're trying to beat the heat, we think you'd have better luck with the Kelvinator Speedy Mount air conditioner on your side.
Other manufacturers got into the game.
And Westinghouse, the people who captured the compact market.
And the units became smaller and more affordable. By the 1960s, millions of air conditioners were sold every year in the U.S. And today, air conditioning has become so popular that it accounts for about 10% of all the electricity we use worldwide. That is a lot of energy for air conditioning, and it's expected to triple in the next 30 years. Most of that electricity comes from burning fossil fuels, so that means more greenhouse gas emissions, which contribute to climate change. And it's a cycle, right? Hotter temperatures lead to more air conditioning, which could lead to even hotter temperatures. The growth in air conditioning is going to come from places where the weather is hot and incomes are growing. So think sub-Saharan Africa and especially India.
I visit my grandparents in Mumbai in India pretty much every year, every other year. And at the time I was growing up in Canada, so I wasn't really used to the heat much. So I would constantly complain.
That's Ashwath Raman. He's a scientist at UCLA. He studies how materials interact with heat and light, and he can trace some of that interest back to those hot summers with his grandparents in the 80s and 90s. He says at the time, practically no one had air conditioning, and certainly not his grandparents.
For them, it was an unimaginable luxury, you know, associated typically with like five-star hotels or the very rich. Now, pretty much every apartment around where my grandmother now lives has an air conditioner.
These days, Raman is working on ways to make air conditioning more energy efficient. He developed a material that's inspired by something pretty old, how ancient Persians made ice in the desert. So they'd pour water into a shallow pool, and then at night the water would freeze, even though the air temperature in the desert was above freezing. That's possible because all objects give off heat. Most of that heat gets trapped in the atmosphere, but a small portion goes up to space. I kid you not. So back to that pool of water in ancient Persia.
It's just sending out more heat than it gets back from the sky as a whole. And so because of that, the surface that's facing the sky will naturally go down below the air temperature.
The caveat is this natural cooling effect only happens at night because during the day the sun gets in the way. So Raman's invention lets heat escape into space but also reflects the sun.
When you combine these two things, you get a very counterintuitive effect. So it's a material which, when it's outside facing the sky and the sun, is actually going to stay colder than the air temperature.
Raman's company, SkyCool Systems, is making roof panels coated in this reflective material, and the panels can be incorporated into a building's existing AC system, making it about 20% more efficient. Raman isn't the only one working on ways to cool us down. There are tons of ideas out there.
Like a giant lung, the structure inhales and exhales as temperatures rise and fall.
Positioning radiant panels on the ceiling with cold water flowing through them.
Triangular screens respond directly to the sun's movement, unfolding like an umbrella when the sunlight hits them.
So there's hope, and we need it, because air conditioning has come a long way since the days of Gori and his ice machine. And it's causing problems too big to ignore. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Maybe you're beating the heat today by hanging out at the beach or sipping a cold beer at a barbecue. Chances are, whatever you're doing, you're not at work because it's the Labor Day holiday. Are you feeling grateful for the long weekend, away from the grind? Don't. If you were French, you get a lot more than one lousy day.
In Europe, in July or August, at some point, they will say, okay, bye-bye, we'll talk to you in the fall.
Emma Seppala is a French native and author of the book, The Happiness Track. She says the French are really onto something.
There's a really strong value for vacations, for life outside of work. So in the U.S., we often think we should live to work. And in France, there's more of this sense of working to live.
But economist Daniel Hammermesh of Barnard College says it wasn't always this way. He says 40 years ago, Europeans and Americans worked roughly the same amount.
It's just that they've moved on, and we have not been able to do that.
These days, Americans put in an average of 1,800 hours of work a year, more than any other industrialized country. So what explains the gap? Hammermesh says it has to do with the lack of government regulation here. The French government, for example, mandates 25 days of paid vacation. If we want that, he says, lawmakers here need to step up.
One needs government intervention, and we are, the United States, just don't believe government can do anything.
So relax at the beach or at that barbecue, but just for today. News headlines are a minute away. You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills. If you're an American kid with Latvian roots, you might not know that much about where your mom came from.
Like, at home, she cooks some Latvian food. We sometimes speak Latvian, and then I go, I think I know what you're talking about.
American teens head to Latvian summer school. That's coming up on The World. Names are important, right? They're not just significant. They can have power. So when it comes to choosing a name, a lot of thought can go into it, like what to name your child, your pet. If you're a musician, what to name your band. Now, there's an existential challenge. Ideally, you want a band name that helps define your ensemble, your sound, your image. From the beginning, Simon Tam knew what he wanted to call his rock band, The Slants. Here's a taste of one of their new songs.
You paint an ugly picture of villains in discourse. It's captioned with your rhetoric, a mirror so deplored in lie. And smile. And lie, 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 and smile.
The Slants have been around since 2006. And Simon Tam, the leader of the band, is Asian American. Calling his band The Slants has gotten him into a lot of trouble. In fact, it landed him in court and eventually the U.S. Supreme Court. Tam wrote about his experience in a new memoir called Slanted, How an Asian American Troublemaker Took on the Supreme Court. Simon, before we get to your Supreme Court case, I want to hear about you. Like what makes you tick?
Well, I would like to believe that I'm driven by this inner desire to see more compassion in the world. And I've chosen to express that through art, through music, and of course, through my work in activism as well. For me, just seeing this idea realized of trying to provide justice for those who are the least represented in our society has been a driving force. And I think a lot of it has to do with my own personal experiences of receiving injustice, of being bullied and violently attacked multiple times as a kid. I just can't see other people experiencing similar kinds of things.
And where did you grow up?
I grew up in San Diego, California, in the kind of early 80s.
What was your family like? What was your upbringing like?
I grew up as a kid of Asian immigrants. My dad was from the Canton region of China. My mom was from Taipei. And I grew up with an older half-brother and a younger sister. It was an interesting experience because we essentially grew up in the back of a Chinese restaurant. Like from age 8 on, I was serving customers, I was bussing tables, and I was kind of viewing life through this lens of what it was like to share our food with people, primarily non-Asians coming into this restaurant and seeing their kind of responses, seeing the interesting kind of judgments, everything from like how they, you know, dealt with fortune cookies, which is not a Chinese thing at all, to how they dealt with our spin on, you know, Chinese American food, like broccoli beef, sweet and sour chicken, and that sort of thing. I think it gave me a lot of lessons about hard work, like seeing my parents work so hard from morning to night, every single day, gave me a view of entrepreneurism and drive. But ultimately, I also saw how hard it was to like operate in the society as Asian Americans, because I mean, I would see customers mocking my mother's accent, and it was heartbreaking, but she would always smile at them. And she always kind of had this idea of like, kill them with kindness. Like you always be the bigger person. You always demonstrate your values and eventually they'll come around. I think that was really, really important to me, even though for years I felt ashamed of who I was. I kind of realized that, you know, we don't actually move the world forward through doing things out of spite or anger. We have to do things out of love and compassion.
Well, it's very interesting because it also leads to your activism around your band, around Asian American issues, and the name of your band, The Slants.
More than dark or light, or surface deep, what's underneath? Whose side will you take when both lie bleeding in the street?
Simon, how did you come up with the name of the band, The Slants?
Well, I actually had the idea for an Asian American band well before I had the name of the band. But as I started asking the people around me, all my non-Asian friends in Portland, I said, what's something you think all Asian people have in common? They would always come back to me and say slanted eyes, which I thought was interesting because, you know, first of all, it's not true. Like not all Asian people have slanted eyes, and we're not the only people on the planet with slanted eyes. But I also reflected back on my childhood experiences because it was these eyes, it was these facial features that got me bullied time and time again. And I was always associated my slanted eyes with a sense of shame. And because Asians are the most bullied demographic in America, I knew that I couldn't possibly be alone in this. And I thought, what if we changed it? What if we talked about our slant on life of what it's like to be people of color and inject the sense of self-empowerment and pride into the term, into this idea instead?
When you suggested that name, what did your bandmates think? Did they instantly like it or did they think, I don't know?
People loved it. I mean, I actually had the band name before I had any band members. So as people were auditioning and I was telling them about the idea, they actually thought it was entertaining. I mean, people approached it from many different angles. Several of the initial band members also had similar childhood experiences to mine. So they just thought this is kind of a punk rock in your face way of throwing it back at people who use racism against us.
Did you get any pushback from anybody about it in those early years?
Not anyone from the Asian American community, no. People kind of understood that he was either this tongue-in-cheek reference or they just thought it was kind of a bold portrayal of Asian American culture. And I think it's also important to understand that Asian Americans had been using the term for about 30 years. We had everything from the Slant Film Festival, which was the second biggest Asian American film festival during its time period, the Slanted Kings of Comedy Tour, Slant Magazine, Slant TV. Like, it was a widely adopted term, and people wanted to use it in this kind of empowering kind of way. So, you know, it wasn't like our community was unfamiliar with the concept or anything like that.
Now, as a group, you've released albums with titles like Slanted Eyes, Slanted Hearts, and The Yellow Album. And it was titles like this, not to mention the band's name, The Slants, that led your case to the Supreme Court. I want you to read a passage from your book that describes the day the court argued your case.
Sure. The queue outside is several thousand long. It's filled with people who waited on the sidewalk all night, including professional line standers who have been hired to hold the place like they would wait for a new iPhone release or U2 concert tickets, hoping to be one of the 250 who will be able to sit inside the courtroom. That was almost me. For the weeks leading up to this day, I wasn't guaranteed a place inside the Supreme Court, even though the case being argued, Lee v. Tam, literally has my name on it. For the past 8 years, I've been locked in a battle with the U.S. government over my band's name. That's right, nearly a decade of slugging it out with the authorities because we wanted to call ourselves The Slants, an identifier that represented self-empowerment while providing a bold portrayal of Asian American culture. That portrayal made bureaucrats uncomfortable. They sent over 36 attorneys working for the Department of Justice and United States Patent and Trademark Office to silence me, fueled false rumors about my work, and put me through perpetual legal drudgery in hopes that I would give up. But I didn't. I believe that The Slants is a name worth fighting for.
Simon, prior to the Supreme Court, what did the various other courts give for not allowing you to trademark your band's name?
For many years, the rest of the kind of trademark system argued that my name was disparaging to persons of Asian descent, and therefore that it could not be registered because there was an old bit of law from the 1930s called Section 2A of the Lanham Act. That law said you can't register trademarks that are considered scandalous, immoral, or disparaging, but it has to be considered disparaging by what they call a substantial composite of the reference group. So in this case, a whole lot of Asian people had to be upset by our name for the government to deny us this registration. The problem was they didn't find a single Asian person who was actually disparaged. So they ended up relying on things like UrbanDictionary.com and using websites like AsianJokes.com to justify their decision.
And why wasn't that proof enough that the name The Slants was not offending Asian Americans?
It's a weird burden of proof if you think about it. Like, it's almost kind of degrading and humiliating to prove that you are not actually offensive to yourself, especially when you're working in the world of social justice. And so we challenged that evidence. We said, you know, first of all, this evidence is kind of questionable at best because you can't even use this in a junior high classroom. And we brought in academics, independent national surveys, linguistics experts, dictionary experts. Yeah, I mean, it became the biggest appeal in U.S. history for a denial under this law. But the government said that it was not good enough. In fact, they called my effort laudable but not influential because they basically put this impossible burden before me that I had to change somebody else's mind, a non-Asian person who thought they knew better than me or anyone else in my community what was good for us. And when you're up against a system that's designed to perpetuate its own laws and its own standards, how can you actually overcome that? Because no amount of evidence I could bring to the table would ever be enough to sway this person who thought they knew better.
And what you were really doing is what has happened many times. You were reappropriating a word that historically had been discriminatory, and you were sort of taking it on and embracing it.
Exactly. You know, and the funny thing is, like, slant has always been kind of this neutral term. It was actually racist people in the 1930s and 40s that kind of appropriated it from the actual description and kind of fused its meaning with people of Asian descent. What my community has been trying to do is saying, like, first of all, having slanted eyes is not offensive because it shouldn't be insulting. And second of all, we want to be able to use this term either in a neutral sense or in this bold, self-empowering kind of way.
The Supreme Court ultimately ruled in your favor. You could keep the band's name, the Slants. What was their reasoning?
They declared the law unconstitutional. They said it was unconstitutionally vague. And under the First Amendment, the government doesn't have the right or the ability to basically decide which kinds of speech are good and which kinds of speech are bad. Because trademarks are private speech. In other words, you as a business owner, nonprofit, or artist choose to use the words however you wish, and they become your property, not the government's property. The government ultimately can't say, hey, your speech here is not appropriate, whereas somebody else's use of it is.
What was it like for you and the band to be there before the justices?
I will say it was probably one of the most surreal experiences of my life. I mean, being there in the room, having Supreme Court justices use your name, use your band's name, and having, you know, one of the highest ranking attorneys in the country use those names is a weird experience, especially since I actually follow Supreme Court politics. But I will say that even though they were referring to me and my band, I never felt so invisible because the government was arguing that, you know, they were talking about a racist band, a band that was doing horrendous things to its own community. And all the while, as I'm sitting there, I'm thinking, that's not me. You don't know me. You don't know my work. You don't know the fact that we actually work with over 140 different social justice organizations across this country. And that whenever the government needed outreach to the Asian American community, whether it was the Department of Defense or the White House under President Obama, they called us. They asked us to do that outreach for them. So it just seemed absurd that I was there in the nation's highest court and being called a racist in a sense. It was also weird that we were arguing for freedom of speech and I couldn't say anything. Like according to the court rules, only my attorney could speak. And it was even more ironic that you had a room full of people arguing about what was offensive to Asian people and the only Asian people in the room could not comment on the matter.
Simon, if you had to, would you do it all over again?
I think so. I think if someone told me what it would take, like that would take up almost a decade of my life and countless resources, that I would be on the brink of bankruptcy. If you told me that at the age I applied, where I was and who I was, I don't think I would have done it. But in hindsight, I realize how important it was to move this conversation forward. And now I have an office wall full of letters from gay and trans attorneys who felt the sting of the government's kind of, you know, the indignity of the process that they were put through when they wanted to reappropriate words. I have other people of color who've been unfairly denied as well. I have women, feminist rock bands, like out of Seattle, Washington, there's a band called Thunder Pussy. They had to endure the same process. And now I have all these letters of people saying, thank you. Thank you for doing this because I wanted to have my own voice. I wanted the ability to decide what was right for me and for my community and not to have someone outside of it, working in a government office who has no connection to these experiences, making that decision for me. So when I look back and look at all of this, I, of course, I would do it again. I wouldn't wish it upon anybody because it's a very long, tiring process. It'll drain you and it'll kind of define who you are for the rest of your life. But still, I'm glad I did it.
Musician and social activist Simon Tam. The title of his memoir is Slanted, How an Asian American Troublemaker Took on the Supreme Court. Thanks a lot, Simon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Remember counting the days, remember grasping for moments. Freedom was a digital way. Remember thinking the world close upon you like an island. Peering through, seeing through. Remember.
This is the song 1821 from Simon Tam's band, The Slants.
Runaway train, remember making a promise to yourself not to be cautious, flawless and wandering. The watchful eyes, the honest.
This is the world.
You
Boston, we're enjoying the very last moments of summer. Most schools here start tomorrow. But for some American teenagers of Latvian ancestry, school was in session over the summer as well. Latvian summer school in the U.S. When Indra Ekmanis isn't working at The World, she directs the West Coast Latvian Education Center outside of Olympia, Washington. And she sent us this postcard.
I've spent more than a third of my summers on this earth at a place called Kursa. First as a student, then as a counselor, now as a director. It's a school where teens have been coming for more than 40 years, from the U.S. and Canada, and even Latvia itself. It kind of looks like your typical summer camp. There's a lake, forest, rustic buildings. But students are also here to learn about the history, language, and folk culture of their families. Ayad Eyman is 17. She's from Los Angeles and has been coming here for 4 years.
There are always things that are new to learn. Like every single day, I learn at least one new word or a new thing about the language that I didn't know or one new move in folk dancing.
With wavy hair in a classic Latvian gray blonde and a wide, inviting smile, Aya looks almost exactly like her mom, Datse, who herself attended the summer school in the 1980s.
We didn't really grow up with the culture of the Latvian culture. Our parents gave us as much as they could. There were Latvian centers that we went to, Latvian school and folk dancing and different things. But to really to come to Kursa and to feel the Latvianism was just as important then as now because it's what you don't have anywhere else.
Latvianism, being Latvian, that can mean all kinds of things, especially if you're 5,000 miles and a generation or two away from the country itself. For some, it's regularly explaining that you speak Latvian, not Latin, with your grandparents. For others, it's celebrating midsummer holidays and eating pīrāgi, delicious bacon-filled buns, or as Alexa Dexter puts it,
a Latvian hot pocket.
For others, it's being part of a community. But being Latvian in America now means that the student body is more diverse, and a lot of Kursa-goers, like me, have only one parent who is Latvian.
So my mom is a Latvian one, ripped out of the bosom of Latvia.
This is Olisa Ikejiani from Portland, Oregon.
And my dad is Nigerian, but like raised in Canada. So kind of within my family, my mom has kind of taken the bullhorns of like culture in the household, right? Like at home, she cooks some Latvian food. We sometimes speak Latvian. She mostly speaks it to me. And then I go, I think I know what you're talking about.
Olisa is a second-year student, learning not only the language, which students can do from any level of proficiency, but also Latvian history, folk dancing, cooking, jewelry making, and maybe most importantly, singing. I ask 15-year-old Dina Moseni from Maryland and 13-year-old Maria Berzinha from Ohio about this.
Like, what are some of the weird activities that, like, are difficult to explain?
Sing about, like, 8 or 9 times a day. Yeah. Just nonstop singing.
But we all, like, we enjoy it.
Yeah, it's like, yeah.
If you explain it to your American friends, they'd be like, that's torture.
Oh, come on. Okay, come on, let's go.
Many of the 30 teens at Kursa today have grandparents who came to the U.S. as refugees during World War II, escaping the Soviet Union, which had occupied the Baltic countries. This is Ella McAuliffe. Her family fled Latvia during the war. Her grandmother was just 6 or 7 at the time.
And it was out of, like, pure luck because, like, the Soviets had come to their house to get them, but they had been, like, away for the day. So they were able to get out of Latvia before, like, someone could come and get them.
For many of these refugees, keeping Latvian culture alive in their new countries was critical. So they started organizations, churches, and schools where children of refugees learned a much different version of Latvian history than was taught in the Soviet Union. In fact, Latvia's current prime minister was born in Delaware and grew up in these communities. Viktors Pupols has been teaching at Kursa for 30 years, and he says these schools played a particularly valuable role during the Cold War, when information exchanges were scarce.
This was an ongoing problem with the refugees and displaced persons, that they wanted to do things and convey information that was not accessible to people in Soviet Latvia because there was a great shortage of information. The West did not know what was going on there, and they did not know what was going on in the West.
That's where schools like Kursa came in.
This kind of filled the gap.
Pēdējos gados Amerikā ir izveidojušās trīs latviešu vasaras vidusskolas.
This is my godmother, Liga Morris, broadcasting to Soviet-occupied Latvia about Kursa in 1980.
Šīs vasaras skolas spēlē svarīgu lomu.
It's on Radio for Europe, a radio station supported by the U.S. government and beamed through Soviet jammers to exchange information between exiles in the West and people in the USSR. Later in the same broadcast, a student from Kursa talks about what she's learning. Her name is Elita Hill, and her daughter, Maya, graduated from Kursa this year. Maya says it can be a challenge to explain to her American friends where she goes every summer.
And they're always like, oh, why would you go to school over the summer? Like, this is the only time we have off. And I'm like, this is my favorite place to be. This is where I want to be. I want to spend all my time here.
One of Maya's closest friends is Aya. We heard from her and her mom, Datsa, earlier. Aya also just graduated from Kursa this summer, and Datsa says it's a phenomenal feeling.
It warms my heart just to know that she had the same experience I did, even though so many years have passed in between.
Aya's still a regular American teen. She knows Latvia's been free from the Soviet Union for longer than she's been alive. But she says Latvia is still a big part of who she is.
What does it mean to be Latvian to you?
Well, for me, it's a second home. Like, when you're with other people that share your love for this country and for how your family came from Latvia, like, it's always going to be a place where people are comfortable to feel whatever they want to feel, whether it's good or bad, and there's always going to be people who support you through that.
To me, Kursa is also like a second home. It's a place where I don't have to explain how to pronounce my name or why I like to spend my free time dancing the polka. For many of us, being Latvian in the U.S. means knowing you have a community to fall back on. When I hear the wind through the trees and smell the pine forest at Kursa, I know I'm in a place where everyone understands what it's like to be connected to a small country while also being part of a very big one. It's like living between two suns, two identities. But maybe that's a shared trait among many Americans. For The World, I'm Indra Ekmanis.
And that's our show for today. Hope you're having a great Labor Day. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We're back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.